Hey there, foreigners. This is Rohit from BreakingTheBorders.com, home of the ambitious immigrants. Today's guest is Ankit Jain. Ankit got his entrepreneurial bug very early in life. He started his first business when he was still doing his undergrad back in India. Ankit, how old were you when you started your first company?
This was not really an official company.
Yeah, the business or freelancing.
I was doing a lot of freelancing work for a lot of clients out there, started building relationships. So it was kind of a pseudo company. I was 19 actually when I started this.
19. Wow, that's very impressive. And as destiny would have it, Ankit ended up in the US on a job with Google. But guess what? 3 years later, he quits it again to continue his entrepreneurial journey. So I invited him to talk to us about how to take this entrepreneurial bug forward, which you seem to have done very well, Ankit. So Ankit, welcome to Breaking the Borders podcast.
Thank you. Thanks, Rohit. Thanks for having me here.
Absolutely. So tell me about your first entrepreneurial venture. What phase of the life were you at that time?
So I guess we are talking about the product I was freelancing work I was doing in my undergrad.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
So yeah, I mean, like I was from a lower middle class family. We used to not have a lot of money, but at the same time, my sister was a doctor and I was doing engineering. So my a lot of our scholarship money was paid through the scholarships. At the same time, I still figured if I can do something on the side, maybe it will help financially a little bit, ease of burden from my parents. That's when I started doing freelancing work. I thought initially that it'll be really hard, that I'll not be able to get clients. And obviously, it's a very competitive world. And I'm sitting in India and most of the clients are out there in US. But what I soon realized is the amount of talent out there in freelancing is varies a lot, and that's how I realized that if I can build good partnership with people who really appreciate talent, I will be able to succeed in it. So that's where I started.
What did you start with? What was your first expertise, or what was your first gig at that time?
Yeah, so I'll move back a little bit further back. When I joined my undergrad, I was very excited about web technologies in general. And very early on, I started working with an organization called IEEE. It's a pretty standard international organization. We had a small Delhi chapter of it in our university. So I started working with them, organizing events and stuff. In the same space, I got involved in the web platform, which was built by the group of IEEE. And they were doing development and building products and features on that web platform. It was essentially a student community portal, where students come and ask questions about anything. It will be related to jobs, related to getting admission into engineering, and related to any technology, related to events. So this was more like a student portal. On the side of it, we used to also host events. So that's where I got to learn a lot about technology. I got to learn a lot about web frameworks and stuff like that. And those were kind of things which got me excited about technology in general. And that's where I started doing freelancing work.
So what kind of freelancing would you do? What was the very first freelancing work you did?
Yeah, I think one of my first freelancing work was building a gaming app. I think this was more about the best timing I had. So this was literally after iPhone's first version was launched in 2007. And until 2008, they never really launched the iPhone SDK, which essentially meant that the only applications which were there in iPhone were the ones which were pre-installed. But this opened opportunity for a lot of developers and a lot of companies out there to actually build applications which look native, but they work on the browser of iPhone.
So the previous apps that were built on iPhone were not respected by Apple anymore, and they had to build a new one.
No. This is the first version of iPhone ever launched.
Oh, okay. So this was back in 2007 when the App Store was just starting.
This is 2007. The SDK wasn't out yet. So people were still figuring out what iPhone is, how we can monetize on it. And that's when a lot of companies out there started building a lot of web applications catered for mobile devices and catered for iPhone. because Android wasn't even there. So that's where like I came in. I found like a couple of companies who were looking for like building web applications on mobile phones, and this was never done before. So it was interesting. I actually learned up a little bit about it. I started bidding for such projects, and I eventually ended up having a few clients who wanted that.
I see. When you say bidding, what platform were you on at that time?
So there were like some of the freelancing platforms. I was like going across as many as I can, just because obviously I was starting. So it was like pretty much wherever I can build relationships. In those days, guru.com was pretty big. I was also using freelancer.com, and there were like a couple of more similar ones. I think none of them actually became like dominated the space. So there were like plenty of them, and projects were posted almost everywhere. So I used to bid at multiple places. Considering I didn't really have good reputation or like had any reputation in the world, it was pretty much I had to bid to the lowest price so that I can at least get the projects and build that reputation.
I see. So that was going to be my question, which is I can see how for new arrivals, it can be hard. I outsource a lot as well for my work. And when I see someone who doesn't have any reviews, mm-hmm. I'm very scared of hiring them. So how did you like try to stand out?
So, I mean, it took a while for sure. Like initially I wasn't like getting picked. At the same time, I was still like learning a lot of new technology. So what I started doing was I started like posting open code around GitHub was on. I don't know whether GitHub was there or not, but I like publicly started like putting code snippets out there, started contributing to the communities, and that's where when I used to bid on the projects, I used to share links of those things, which kind of like developed the credibility for me.
I see. So you had to slowly build the engine.
Now things have become a lot more streamlined, and people can use GitHub. It's a very standard thing to use GitHub Stack Overflow links when you're trying to show your reputation.
Do you remember the first money you ever made on that platform?
Oh yeah, I definitely remember. It was a $200 check which I got. And it was funny that I actually got this check delivered to my home physically, and I had absolutely no idea how to actually cash out a check which is written in dollars instead of rupees.
So this was back in India, so you weren't sure.
Back in India, yes. And I had like I was like trying to figure out, okay, maybe I have to ask for a rupee check or something. But when I went to the bank, they were like, oh yeah, we accept dollar checks all the time, and it was all fine. But it was really interesting, like that $200 which I made over a project of 2 weeks. This was, if you look at it in current, converting it in Indian currency, it was back then 10,000 rupees for 2 weeks. It was a substantial amount of money for a person who was doing projects on the side in college. Like my college tuition for a whole year, including hostel, used to be 25,000 rupees, which is like $500. And if you're like able to get like $200 out of it straight away, it feels very satisfying.
Yeah. And you also mentioned about the other financial struggles you and your family may have had. Did it have anything to play with your zeal to, you know, go out there, figure this out, make money somehow?
I mean... Like, I think it went rather the other way around. Like, I realized that living with... So, my mom and dad both used to work, and they still... Well, my dad's retired now, but my mom still works. She has a full-time job. And we grew up in a family where both parents are working. We realized, like, money is hard to come. But at the same time, I also realized that that people can survive with, like, not a lot of money. At the same time, like there is like ways to even go by without so much money. So it kind of like, instead of like fighting a lot for money, I kind of like developed that, okay, there will be ups and downs in life, but obviously money should not be the driving factor for things. It should also be all out for learning.
I see. So that's interesting. You said it actually gave you an opposite perspective, as well as you actually don't need that much. How about PlayScreen? When did you start working with them?
So PlayScreen was one of my actually early projects. I started working with them, I think.
What is PlayScreen? Can you just quickly describe for someone who's listening who doesn't know?
Actually, back in those days, the name of the company was called MyNumo, and they're essentially a casual gaming company. So they used to make, back in those days, like games for Flash Player for web, like web browser. But when mobile devices came in, their business entirely changed, because like mobile games became a lot bigger than the web-based Flash games. And And that's when they kind of like found me. We kind of connected well. Like I did a project for them. I think it was $300, one of the first projects I did, like, which was another game on mobile. And it was interesting because I think I built Blackjack game for them. That was my first game ever. It took a while, obviously, initially, because I didn't have a framework. I had to build a lot of things for them. It took probably like a month kind of to build that product for them. But at the same time, I got to learn a lot. And in fact, that game was featured in one of the online articles as it was compared to the Blackjack built by Yahoo. And it was said like the PlayScreen's Blackjack is a lot better in terms of like experience on a mobile device than Yahoo Blackjack. More because Yahoo Blackjack was never built for mobile. So it was a web-based thing. So if you look in mobile, it doesn't really feel that good. It doesn't give you a good experience. But when I built it on mobile for iPhone, that kind of like got a lot of popularity.
Yeah, that's very impressive. So you as one person could actually build an app and compete with the giant that Yahoo is. We probably had this whole development team, right?
I agree. I think it's more about just the timing. I'm pretty sure like later on they had somebody who rebuild the whole game for mobile. It was more about like it was very early in days of where iPhone was and mobile games was not very popular. And perhaps we were like the first ones to see that mobile games could become big, even in browser without even downloading an application. And perhaps like Yahoo realized it a little later, or that was not some of their priorities to work on.
Yeah. So you did the Blackjack game for PlayScreen, and then it was successful. Did they come back to you? Did they ask you to make more games?
Oh, yeah, definitely. So after that game, they were very impressed with my turnaround time and my product quality. We actually built pretty good relationships with them. They were a team out of actually Oregon up here. I actively worked on quite a lot of games for them. I think over the time, I built like 7 games for them. And these were like all mobile-based games, like web browser-based games. Later on, they started doing more native mobile applications because iPhone SDK became popular after that. And definitely people use that more now. But like it was more about the timing that I get to work on such cool games.
I see. So for them, for PlayScreen, they must have been a big company themselves as well, right? Why would they outsource building a game like this versus building a team internally?
I mean, so one thing is obviously it's always hard to find engineers, good engineers. So like they try to outsource, and obviously it would have been a lot more expensive for them to do it here versus in India. Because if you look at it, I actually charge them about somewhere between $300 to $500 per game. And this was, if nothing, this was like about 20, 30 hours of work for me. So this would have been like a lot more expensive if they would have done it here.
I see. So it is cost competitive also, and they're getting the quality as well. Egyptian casino company, when did they find you?
I mean, it was, again, like after I built those games for PlayScreen, I think they gave me a pretty good rating and we did like multiple games. So after that, it was very like projects were coming in a lot more easier. And I pretty much paid off my tuition for the whole 4 years within like less than a year. And I think Egyptian Casino was really interesting because the funny thing was he was actually trying to recruit me and come there and join his team. And it was kind of like very awkward because I've never really met that guy before. And at some point I felt like, okay, this is awkward. But I did work with him on a few small projects. I'd like build some of his web application. He was a pretty cool guy. And I think it was one of the projects I kind of did. But the only...
They wanted you to move to Egypt and work for them?
So he said like he's actually leading, like he was the technology leader for one of the casinos in Egypt. And he was like, I actually need to build a team here. So would you be interested in moving there? Like we never really discussed compensations kind of things though. But it was just like very interesting that he was like looking for me, like people to move to Egypt from India.
So I think you mentioned earlier that that was one of the highest paychecks that you ever got for any work, right? What was it?
I think he paid me somewhere close to $1,000. I think that was like how much he paid me for that project. And obviously, like after you like deduct taxes and everything, it comes down to a lot lower. But still, yeah. I think that was like one of the bigger paychecks I got.
Do you remember how you celebrated?
I think I celebrated definitely more the first paycheck I ever got rather than that $1,000. I did end up like buying a motorcycle after that, though. So that was definitely like worth it. But I really enjoyed working on all of those projects.
Yeah. And then you graduated from your undergrad and you moved on to working full time, and you didn't have enough time to do this freelancing on the side. Mm-hmm. And you were working in the start or in the corporate world for a few years. And how did you end up in the US from there?
I think it was more about timing, being very lucky in that sense. Like working at Google was one of my dreams. Like I think it was like a video I saw from Google back in 2006 or 7, where they would talk about like life at Google of engineers. And after that, I was like, man, this is the place I want to work at. And
what was in that video? Do you remember?
I remember like there were like definitely gyms, a lot of free food, and like those bicycles, the shuttles, the massage, and the nap pods. So it's like kind of a lifestyle which we have never experienced.
Yeah.
We had never experienced before. So at that point, I was like, oh, I'd really want to work there. So I did apply at Google back then. Like Google did come to our campus for recruiting. But since my resume was not that impressive, I never really heard back from them.
Anyone from your college get into Google at that time?
Nobody got in.
Okay.
Yeah. So I think it was like, they were just like looking if somebody has pretty impressive background. But obviously being in an undergrad in India, it's like you don't really get a lot of industry exposure. So we didn't really have that strong background. So at that point, I thought like, okay, maybe this is destiny. I cannot get into Google around now. Maybe I'll try it in future. So then I joined like my first company, which was Cisco. And 1.5 years down the line, I joined a company called Adobe. So when I was at Adobe around the end of it, like somehow I just got an email on LinkedIn, which was almost like unbelievable to me that somebody pinged me on LinkedIn, a recruiter from Google Mountain View, asking if I would want to interview for a position in Mountain View.
This was when you were back in Bangalore.
This was actually in Adobe. I was in Bangalore, Cisco, 1.5 years. Then I moved to Adobe. This was Noida.
Noida. Okay. So this is back in India, and then Google in Mountain View contacts you.
Yeah. Google in Mountain View contacted me.
Yeah. So what did you do?
Initially I thought like this is kind of a scam. I didn't really believe it. I had like a conversation with him. Then I kind of like started believing, okay, maybe this is real. And then I was like interviewed, and we're talking about like, then they like, obviously after the interview, I was like, okay, this is definitely real. Very excited.
So you moved to Google in Mountain View. So did you go take a nap in the nap pod, go for eat the free food,
like,
and take the slide down the...
Yeah, I was there for like 3.5 years. Google is definitely an amazing place to work at. It's like it cares for you a lot. And like obviously all the amazing perks they have. Yes, I did slide down the slides. I took the nap at the nap pod. I had so many massages. And more importantly, I actually met a lot of very smart people there.
Mm-hmm. What were you doing at Google?
So at Google, I was working in their ads engineering, where interesting thing was I was actually working on building their HTML5 infrastructure for ads. So which was essentially before Google, I was working in Adobe, where I was building the Flash player for iPhone. And after that didn't really work out, after like fighting with Steve Jobs, Google somehow thought like, okay, this guy probably knows Flash a little bit. Maybe we should hire him to kill Flash and work on HTML5 ads.
I see. So when you moved to the US from India, and I hear it from people who moved while working, that there's a lot of cultural difference between working in India versus working in US. Did you experience a lot of that? And what was the difference for you?
I definitely experienced some of it. Like, for instance, even my accent was pretty strong. Like, Indian English accent, had a hard time communicating. Even, like, talking to people, sometimes I had to, like, obviously, a lot of times I had to, like, ask them to repeat, talk slowly. And other than that, in terms of like food, like I had dietary restrictions. So being vegetarian also kind of like restricts how much I can eat outside, hang out and socialize with people. Like even it is very casual here around like going out and drinking, which was also not very common for me. But like I definitely got used to it. Like my colleagues were very helpful in that. And luckily, like I was in a team which had a lot of people from a foreign nationality. So it was a mix of people. And I would say there was not very strong American like culture or anything which I had to worry about. And like almost everyone was very welcoming and helpful. So made really good friends at Google. And definitely they helped me like get past over these social barriers.
So you're back in corporate life, right? Mm-hmm. And you were there for a long time, like 3 years in India or 2 years mm-hmm. so in India, and then 3 years more in Google. Mm-hmm. What made you put all that behind and leave the mm-hmm. Napas, leave the free food and all, and take another jump out of your comfortable life?
Yeah, I mean, I think like, again, it comes back to where I was like working as a freelance developer, like building my business there. It kind of like gives me a pleasure of like being able to work independently. And that's kind of like what I started missing at Google as well, like being able to make a huge difference. It's definitely, I get to learn a lot at Google, met really cool people, but at the same time, there was like this itch of like doing something myself, being more independent, building products from ground up. That kind of thing, over the time when I was like talking to a lot of people, over the time it kind of developed and bubbled up and finally helped me make the decision
of quitting Google. What did you do in the few months leading up to that in terms of finding your next gig?
Yeah, I mean, like it was not really a sudden move, to be honest. Like 2 years down Google, I like started talking to a lot of people. I thought like I'm in Silicon Valley, I get to like definitely know a lot of people. So I started talking to some of the investors around here, started talking to some of the startup founders around here, attending many of the startup events, and like kind of realized like there's like a lot more things I can do, be excited about. And I was doing that for over a year before I decided to leave Google. And I think it was more about like just talking to people, trying to understand how the life outside of Google is and how like what people really do.
Do you remember the last day at Google?
It was very emotional. Like obviously I was in Google for 3.5 years, which is essentially almost as long as a college is. So definitely made very, very good friends there. And even till I walked outside of the door, it was really hard for me. I was like thinking maybe I'm doing a mistake. I should reconsider what I'm doing. At the end of it, like, I think I'm happy I made that decision to make the jump. Like, I really still appreciate Google a lot for what it is, but there's a lot more adventures out there, which I really want to be part of.
So the adventure that you were part of immediately was HomeJoy.
Right.
What were you doing at HomeJoy?
So HomeJoy, I talked to HomeJoy, I think I was talking to them for like 4 or 5 months before I actually joined them. So
talking as in interviewing with them or just trying to connect with them?
Like early on, I think we interviewed around January, I think. And then we were talking about like the offer itself, but we were also talking about like what I'll be doing there, how the life is and those kind of things, and what my career would look like, how where the company is going, what the product is. So it was definitely a lot of conversations I had. Like it was a big decision for me. I did not know. I mean, even though I was like was trying to be a part of startup world for a long time, I still did not know what exactly to look for in a startup. I definitely knew I wanted to join a consumer startup, and that's primarily where I was like talking to most of the companies. What I liked about HomeJoy was there were like fewer consumer startups back then who were actually like doing, like making money in terms of like being transactional. And HomeJoy was one of them. And when I was talking to their engineer.
What was HomeJoy at that time? Can you tell a little bit about what they did? So
for people who do not know, HomeJoy was a house cleaning, on-demand house cleaning service where people can actually where we had like a huge army of cleaners who are contractors, and they provide them us with their schedules, and we would like book appointments on their schedules using algorithms, and we would like suggest customers on how what all appointments they can book, and like we build a web infrastructure for that.
It's like an Uber for house cleaning.
It was like Uber for house cleaning, but we were there for other services as well, but house cleaning was definitely our bigger market.
Okay. Mm-hmm. And what happened to Homejai that you eventually had to move out?
Well, what happened to Homejai is like out there in news everywhere. It was definitely a lot of learning experience. I would say the biggest reason that Homejai went down was that we focused too much on the growth. That growth was effectively driving the product rather than product drive the growth. And like we did look at some of the numbers. We were looking at like the growth numbers, which were always really good. Some of the numbers which we kind of forgot to look at were like retentions, as in like the customers coming back again for booking. That was like always very low. We did not really focus a lot on improving those numbers.
So Homejai's team went over to Google at that time, right? Homejai's team was recruited by Google, like you mentioned.
Yeah.
Right? How would that happen?
I guess like at some point when Homejai realized that this is not going anywhere, that we're losing a lot of money, it was at some point we were like trying to find a home for Homejai. So that's when we approached Google, and Google obviously is always looking for strong engineering. So that's why they were like, okay, sure, we will interview your engineering team. If we feel like they're good, we'll hire them.
Mm-hmm. I see. So just getting or being jobless or moving from company to company must be very different for you as an immigrant in the US, right? Coming from a different country and living here on a visa. Mm-hmm. So when Homejai was shut, what was happening with your status, and how were you able to continue?
That's a very good question. So when Homejai was shutting down, like it was around 2-3 months at the end that we knew that there's definitely something, like there's a good chance that Homejai would shut down. And we were like trying to figure out, like obviously I had to like figure out what to do, being on a visa. My manager, Mark, he was supportive of me. He kind of told me that I'll help you. Like because of the visa, I want to give you a heads up. Like if you want introductions at any companies, I'll help you do that just so that you have a backup. He was helpful there. And I think being an engineer in Bali, it's not that hard to find a job. Especially like when everyone is looking for engineering talent. And I knew like I'll be able to, like with my background, I'll be able to find another job. It was just a matter of, I didn't want to actually join another company where I would like end up not being very happy and quit. So it was more about like, how do I, in this amount of time, how do I find the right move for me?
So what did you find at that time?
So yeah, that was really good, right? So I got me enough time to actually figure out what to do. Last 2-3 months, I was just exploring opportunities. I was talking to some of the companies. At the same time, I always had that startup bug with me. I was like trying to build something on the side, see if I can make it big. Obviously, like doing something on the side, it's always don't give you enough time. That's when one of my friends told me about this company or like this angel fund called Unshackled. So Unshackled, if people do not know, is essentially a fund which helps immigrant entrepreneurs. Like they focus primarily on immigrant entrepreneurs. They help them with visa situations and fund their companies. So I did talk to Manan and Nitin, who actually run the organization. It was weird because I literally like cold emailed them one day. I got a response from them the other day, which was very surprising. And we had like a they asked me, like, they invited me for drinks. So I, like, had met them over drinks. And, like, they just decided to give me an EIR role. So this, all of that.
What is EIR? Happened.
So EIR stands for Entrepreneur in Residence. This is essentially, this was, like, their pilot program. They were trying to figure out themselves. So Unshackled is a pretty new fund. They were trying to figure out if they can actually hire an individual rather than hiring or, like, supporting a company, so an individual can come and explore different opportunities and try to figure out what he can build and take it from there. So and then after that, they'll be able to fund that person as a company. Mm-hmm. So it's essentially like a step before you'll build a company. And they were piloting this program, and I was actually like the first EIR they hired. So it was like, at that point, even they didn't know what to expect from an EIR. I didn't know what to expect from an EIR. So it was definitely an interesting learning experience for both of us.
So it was really fortunate that they were trying to pilot it at the exact same time.
Yeah, this is, I think, like, again, most of my life has been about timing. At Unshackled, when I emailed them, that was literally like 2 days before they shut down their first application of EIR. I didn't even know that they had an EIR program, because they didn't really like promote it anywhere. I think they posted it on some forum, which I never really saw. Mm-hmm. So when I
how did you learn about it?
I learned about Unshackled from one of my friends.
I see. Okay.
They told me that they heard about it in some news. So I did look up what Unshackled was. I was like, okay, maybe I should give them a call, figure out what they are.
Okay.
So I dropped them an email. They responded back. And they told me about this EIR program. They said, like, the application is closing tomorrow. You should actually just go and apply today itself.
Yeah.
So I did an application, and then they called me for drinks.
Yeah. Yeah, for those, for people who are listening, if there is more questions about what the EIR program is and how Unshackled works, I actually did an interview with the founder of Unshackled, Nitin Pachisia, and I will leave the interview in the show notes as well. They're basically, they sponsor your H1 before you start working on your own company, and they give you office space and a paycheck to justify H1B. Did I sum that up right, Ankit?
Yes, I think it's not just about office space. They're primarily like angel fund.
Okay.
So it's not like they would sponsor anyone. They do like a proper due diligence. They check, like, want to know the founders first, want to understand the product. Like, they have a proper application process. At the end of it, yes, they work somewhat similar to an incubator where they give them office space. But obviously, they have a strong immigration team, lawyers team who help people with visas. At the same time, they have a strong network of their LPs, which is limited partners who are their investors who help us connect with a lot of investors in the Valley as well.
Yeah, their lawyers are very creative. One of the lawyers, Michael Cerrote, I met him several times for many immigration questions that I had personally as well. He always finds a way in any situation, which is very encouraging.
He's pretty good with this, yes.
Do you get a paycheck as well, being an EIR?
I mean, so legally, I'm like, obviously, I have to have a paycheck. So yes, I do get a paycheck. They do pay me, like, not enough to survive in Silicon Valley. Obviously, the prices of apartment rents here are crazy. But luckily, I had some savings of my own to actually survive. They do give me a paycheck to like meet the criteria for the visa requirements.
Mm-hmm. So you joined as an EIR and you started building projects there as well,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
Which one was first? Was it Rent to Buy or Rent Escape?
So Rent Escape was my actually second project I worked on, but this was the third project. But anyways, it was one of the projects which I worked on for the longest time. I worked on for about 3 months, starting from Labor Day weekend all the way to Thanksgiving. And essentially, the product was rent to buy of outdoor gear. And the reason I was doing it is
Rent to Buy was not the name of the product. It was the name of the model. I messed up in taking my notes.
Right. So Rent Escape was the name of the company. And what I was doing was essentially enabling people to go on outdoor adventures. So I have been a pretty active outdoor person myself. I used to organize... not anymore, but I used to organize a lot of outdoor events socially, like nonprofit, and I really enjoy like being in the outdoors. So like over the years, I collected so much gear myself from some of the stores that I realized like, okay, I do not really use that so often. So maybe it makes a lot of sense for me to be able to share it with others. That's when I built Rent Escape. This was mostly like a pilot program. I was going to run it for a week over Labor Day weekend. But like the amount of response I got from Labor Day weekend, I kind of like decided to actually pursue it a little further.
So you got good response. What does it mean in terms of if you were to quantify?
So in terms of like, I actually launched it less than a week before Labor Day weekend. And for the Labor Day weekend itself, I got like orders of over $1,000, which was pretty surprising and interesting. I was not expecting that. So I had to actually hustle around, find all those equipments for people, and then deliver it to them.
I see.
It was definitely a lot of fun experience.
So you posted it even without having the equipment, in the hopes that you will be able to procure them once you have the orders, and you did get the orders, and you had to.
Exactly. Like since I built it on such a short time, it was hard for me to actually like ask everyone for all the equipments beforehand. I did ask some of my friends, but at the end of it, like I realized, like if people come on the platform and they don't find the products, they're not going to book it. So what I did was I actually posted the products even though I didn't have it.
I see. That was very smart. That was very entrepreneurial of you to do that.
I mean, you have to do what you have to do.
Yeah. Peer-to-peer gear sharing, was it also a part of it?
Yeah, so it originally started that way. That's why I was asking my friends for the gear. So it essentially like started as a model which was peer-to-peer gear shared. That was what we launched on Liberty Weekend. It eventually evolved into rent to buy more because like it made more sense in business sense that way. One of the reasons was the model with rent to buy, I was able to build partnership with the outdoor brands to support such a model. The pricing for customers would still remain the same. The only difference was instead of them being able to rent it from their friends, they rent it from this business, because that way I was able to control the quality of the product.
What were some of the partnerships that you made at that time?
So I was talking to a lot of brands, like most of the outdoor brands. I did talk to MSR, which is one of the big brands. We closed a partnership with them called Thermarest. That's also like a big brand. Then I was talking to North Face. I did talk to Outdoor Research and Mountain Hardware. So we were having like ongoing conversations with them. And interesting thing was I was talking to like a lot of CEOs of very big old companies.
Yeah. Who is Joe?
Joe is the owner, he's the CEO of outdoor company MSR and Thermarest. So I did send him an email, a long email. I was surprised he actually read all of it. I sent him a long email explaining what the product is, what I'm looking for. And he replied back, interested in having a conversation. So we had a conversation. I did talk to their VP of sales after that, and we finalized a partnership with them.
Yeah. So you did have a partnership with them in the sense that they would give you the products that you can rent.
Right. Then... So they were offering some of the initial products for free to us, for us to experiment, try this model. And they were really like supportive of this concept.
Were you the only one doing this at that time?
I was the only one. I did start finding like co-founders and people who will help me. I did like find a couple of people who were helping me on the side. But full time, I was the only one who was doing it.
I see. You mentioned when we were talking earlier that was one of the mistakes that you may have done with the company, not having a team. Why do you think that is?
Because I think this is kind of a lesson learned the hard way for me. If I would have done this, if I would have been more active about finding the co-founder, we would have like been able to get more progress, get more work done in the company, and like be able to come to the decisions a lot faster than it took me. Like, I think having two people team is four times stronger than having a one person team. So I would give like this kind of an advice to all founders out there to definitely go and find a co-founder for yourself.
A co-founder who can complement the skills that you don't have.
Complement the skills, who you can work well together. Like, he'll be a person who's like almost your partner in life. Mm-hmm. So it has to be definitely very well looked at and definitely somebody you can work well for a long time.
Why outdoor equipment only?
I mean, it was more of like, I definitely thought that this can go in other spaces, but outdoor equipment is something which is less often used by people. At the same time, I understood the space very well.
You were an outdoor person yourself as well?
Yes. And at the same time, the price of the products is relatively higher than some of the other things.
Why? You only shut that down, right? Did you?
Yes.
How do you make that decision?
I mean, it was definitely a hard decision, but like I did talk to, as I said, like Unshackled does help you connect with a lot of people. So I did talk to a lot of founders and investors. I kind of like got an idea that I need to look at the numbers and metrics better. So when I started looking at like how the economics is doing on the whole business model, I realized like it requires a lot of capital to run the business at the same time, the profits which I'll be making out of this business would be very small. Mm-hmm. And that kind of was alarming for me to see. And it kind of like, as a business, it did not make a lot of sense to do it. Definitely, yeah. I think this could just work as a nonprofit if I would like not put like an on-demand support on this. But as a business, this did not make a lot of sense to execute.
Since the margin is low, you can only make profit when it with scale. And scaling is a hard thing in the sense that you need to put a lot of developers.
Scaling is not particularly a hard thing, but definitely it needs a lot of capital to make it scale.
Not hard. And that's what I meant. Capital intensive.
Right. It's capital intensive thing, and definitely something which would take a long time to become profitable. And I think I did not want to build a product which would live on only VC money for a long time.
Hmm. So you shut that down. What did you do after that?
So after that, I was exploring certain opportunities. I did like meet one of the other founders at Unshackled. His name is Matt. Now I actually work with him. So I was talking to him about the product he's working on. It's essentially a platform on sports. I met him in September when he came to US. He was actually...
He's an immigrant too?
He's an immigrant as well. Most of the people at Unshackled are.
Yeah.
He's an immigrant. I met him at Unshackled.
From which country?
He's originally from Australia, but he was living in UK for about 5 years. And that's where he actually pitched one of the events of Bloomberg. One of the investors at Unshackled actually like talked to him, found him, and they told him about Unshackled, and they connected them together, and Unshackled did a process review, and like they decided to bring him on.
I see. So what happened when you met with Matt at Unshackled?
So I met with Matt. Like, I definitely believed in his vision. He was trying to help all the people globally out there, all the sports people, all the sports talent to be able to be discovered. So essentially, Sportpal is a talent, is a sports talent discovery platform, and his mission was to make talent discovery possible regardless of your gender, your socioeconomic factors, your parents' income, or your race, so and your geolocation. So essentially, Sportpal enables people to be like sports talent to be discovered all across the globe.
So how does it work? If I have some talent in sport, mm-hmm. what do I need to do to be?
If you're a talented sports person and you really do not have like enough resources to actually like hire an agent, what you do is you essentially create a profile on Sportpal. Record a video from your phone of you playing yourself, show some of the like real games you've played, your talent, and like also update all your statistics about like what visa nationality you have and some of the references if you can. And based on that, you'll be able to like reach out to some of the clubs and agents across the globe who are like recruiting for such talent.
Oh, wow. That seems like a very interesting niche.
Yeah, exactly. That's what kind of like I realized. And obviously, I really like the mission of it itself, that it's we do not charge players at all because we believe that the talent should not depend on your parents' income. We do charge the clubs and agents because they are the ones who are actually looking for the talent and they are hungry for it and they can afford it. Mm-hmm. So that's our business model. And I really believed in like how he was building the product.
What stage was he at with Sportpal when you joined his team?
So Matt definitely has a very strong sports background. He's been a sports player and agent himself, but he's not a very he doesn't know technology very well. So that's where I came in. Like before I joined, he had a company in Romania outsourced who was building the product. So when I came in, I realized like the product didn't really have much legs. So I had to like rebuild a lot of platform for them. But before I joined, they literally had the product, a barely functioning product, which was built in a team by a team in Romania.
I see. So they were having a platform which was not very robust in some mm-hmm. sense, and you came and took it to the next level at that time.
Right. I mean, so like as I said, like finding a co-founder is definitely hard. I met Matt in September, but at the same time, September of 2015, I was talking to him for a long time. Like we did talk about like terms and everything. At the same time, I was trying to figure out how a person he is to work with. So I think I really enjoyed working with him. So I kind of told him like we'll do a test work together. So we did that starting December and all the way till January. And
what does test work mean? That sounds very interesting.
It essentially meant that I'm working for him unofficially in the expectation that I'll join you full time. But at the same time, I'm just trying to learn to work together well.
I see.
So it was more about like just, it's more like a dating period we had before we got married. So it was like we took 2 months to work together. We saw how the dynamics were working. And I think I really enjoyed working with him. That's when we made it official in January end.
Nice. You are using the exact same terms like marriage. And there seem to be a lot of parallels there. I like the way you are stating it. But is it, I've never heard this before. So I'm curious to know, is it very common in entrepreneurial circles to be?
Honest, it's not that common. I think it is somewhat essential unless you know the person very well. So like I know a lot of, there's like many different sites out there who help you find a co-founder. Wherever you can find a co-founder, you should do that. But the only thing is you have to be very, very careful about how you choose one, because you have to be working with them a lot longer. You'll probably be working with anybody else for a long time.
Yeah, I've heard of many people who've had bad founders. I wish they did something that like you did.
Right. I mean, definitely, like there's ups and downs. Like it's not like we don't argue at all. It's more about like we argue more openly. We have open communication. If we have issues about anything, we talk very openly about it. And I think that's what I really like about our relationship.
What's next for Sparple?
So the next is we are brought on a very strong advisory board for us, which essentially is the president of 49ers and one of the biggest agents in basketball. So what we are doing now is we are doing some of the finishing touches for our user experience, as well as we are moving forward to launch our platform for basketball. And that's going to be one of our bigger sports, as opposed to right now we spend most of our efforts in rugby. Although it supports basketball, we do not put a lot of effort into it. So our next step is definitely to promote basketball on the platform.
I see. So you're going sport by sport and you attacked rugby first and now it's time for basketball.
Right. And at the same time, we are also fundraising to make sure that we can reach the next level.
Yeah. I wish you all the success and I hope you become so big and you come back here and do the interview on how you built it again.
Let's hope so. Thanks, Rohit.
Yeah. So what, before we part here, Ankit, what advice do you have for someone who is just trying to figure it out in the entrepreneurial world, or what advice do you give?
I think like over the 6 months, I definitely learned a lot of things. I kind of briefly mentioned most of those already. One of them is like, if you have an interesting idea which you think is good, one of the few things you should do is first figure out whether economically that idea makes sense. And second, how many people will be using it. And third, probably like the most important, that should be the first one, is find a co-founder. Definitely need somebody, a partner in crime, before you can build a good successful business.
I like how you stated it in a very crystal clear bullet point. So if someone listening wants to get in touch with you, what is the best way to contact you?
I mean, you can contact me on LinkedIn or you can drop me an email, ankit@sportpal.com. I'll be more than happy to talk to you, give you advice. I do help a lot of people out there. I'm actively also helping a lot of ex-Google community who wants to like jump into the startup world.
Are you on Twitter?
I'm on Twitter as well. My Twitter handle is out and away.
Out and away. Okay. That's an interesting one.
It's related to, yeah, my... passion for outdoors, for sure.
Ankit, this has been a blast. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Rohit. Thanks for having me here. It was really fun talking to you.
That was Ankit Jain, the founder of Sparple. Today, I learned two important things from Ankit. One is persistence and second one is never getting comfortable. Ankit persisted a long time in all his endeavors and success did follow. And he also never let his guard down or let the comfort of day-to-day life take over his ambition, which is also, I believe, very important. All the show notes from today's episode can be found at breakingtheborders.com/Ankit, A-N-K-I-T. And make sure you subscribe while you're on the page to get latest updates. Until next week, stay ambitious.